Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 3 of Crave Arts Presents The Future of Film, featuring intimate interviews with the best emerging filmmakers from around the world. My name is Tom Oliva, and I am co-founder and executive director of Crave Arts and the All-American High School Film Festival, dedicated to discovering, showcasing, and uniting the next generation of visual storytellers and content creators. Some quick updates from the All-American Bulletin Board as we gear up for our 10th annual festival in New York City. Our 2022 festival takes place this October 21st to 23rd, and all of our ticket options are currently on sale via our website and Film Freeway. Our Elite All Access Pass early bird pricing is available through August 5th, and submissions are still open via Film Freeway with the final deadline on July 1st. Head over to hsfilmfest.com to get the latest news and updates about the 2022 festival, including our 2021 highlight reel, downloadable 2022 budget guide, planning guides, and posters, because it's never too early to begin planning your all-American adventure. A friendly reminder that we are offering two new custom categories this year. They're totally free and open until July 1st. We have the End Distracted Driving PSA category, offering you the chance to submit original PSAs about the dangers of distracted driving, and the Representation Through Storytelling category, presented by Storyblocks, invites you to submit a short film or documentary that reflects the diverse world we live in and highlights the stories of historically excluded voices. More information at hsfilmfest.com/2022-custom-categories. And if you plan on attending the fest in New York City, we highly recommend competing in our film invitational competitions, the world's premier on-site student filmmaking competitions in New York City. We offer a variety of authentic, real-world production experiences for student filmmakers and video production programs, your chance to crew up and produce a short film in just 10 weeks. Registration is open. I first met today's guest, Kelly Yu, an alumni from 2019, under unprecedented circumstances. You see, Kelly never submitted her outstanding sci-fi film, Supplementary, for consideration. So then, how did it win the award for Best Screenplay and earn nominations for Best Overall Film and Best Visual Effects? That is a long, but hopefully worthwhile story to tell. In September of 2019, just a few weeks before the festival, I received an email from Kelly. It read, quote, "I was recently alerted by a friend who saw the trailer for the film fest that was uploaded on your Instagram account about shots of my short film making it in. I have never submitted my film to any festival and was not aware of this one. Can I speak to someone about this?" Surely she was mistaken, right? How would we have her film if she didn't submit it? Long story short, someone had stolen her film online, changed the title sequence and credits, and submitted it as their own. It took us a few very busy days and some serious detective work to figure this out. This was scary for us, and even scarier for Kelly. And it led us down a collective rabbit hole of the lengths that some desperate people will go to plagiarize another person's work. It was an unfathomable theft that none of us expected. And it wasn't just evil and sad. It was definitely illegal. If Kelly's astute friend hadn't seen our promo reel, she and we would have never known that this unconscionable act had occurred, and likely the thief would have earned the praise that Kelly deserved and thankfully received. Thanks to Kelly's remarkable grace and profound ability to favor forgiveness and kindness over warranted revenge, we handled the matter privately with the thief's family and teacher, and we can only hope that the individual responsible learned a very valuable lesson about artistic and personal integrity, traits that Kelly possesses in abundance. But this introduction isn't about Kelly Yu, the victim. It is about Kelly Yu, the filmmaker, and the light definitely shines bright on her talents. Her website bio helps pull back the curtain of her diverse background, skill set, and extensive production credits. It reads, "Kelly Yu is a Swedish-born, New Orleans-raised, Chinese-American writer, director, and photographer. Her work is driven by a distinct voice and visual style, shaped by her experiences navigating three different cultures, as well as a fascination with finding humanity in the absurd. She's also been running her own photo and editing freelance business since she was 15, and has a list of clients and film accolades too numerous to name. Her award-winning All-American film, Supplementary, offers ample early evidence of her ability to illuminate elemental aspects of humanity while surrounding such rich themes in story concepts so unique that powerful universal truths feel utterly new. My first instinct is to say that Kelly creates art about love. And this is certainly true. Whether you are watching her films, perusing her photographs, or appreciating her investment as an editor, you cannot escape the gravity of love pulling you in. Although I know that she invests tremendous effort in her work, the film feels effortless, seamlessly blending engaging characters, conflicts, and tone equally with an abundance of visual wealth. Exploring her most recent work, created while attending film and television production at the USC School of Cinematic Arts, reveals a distinct maturation of her talents. The same themes emerge: studies in humanity and testaments to love that ambitiously straddle accents of humor and grief, all leading to an increased immersion that invites the viewer to ponder the subtle depths. A less careful viewer might assume that Kelly's vision is solely focused on the far out, but they would be missing the best part of her enviable work, the spine that holds it all together while connecting us all. I am honored to be joined by Kelly Yu today. We share quite a story together. Hi, Kelly. Welcome. How are you?
Hi, Tom. I'm good. Thank you so much for that kind introduction. Oh my gosh.
Well, after what so we've kind. Been through, it is my pleasure to praise your work. That is really what we're here to talk about. I have so much respect for what you do, and I'm so thrilled to see how your talents have matured. I want to talk about everything, but of course, we have to get the conversation going with a little segment we call Personal Portrait. In this quick reply exercise, I'll say a word or a question, and you just say the first thing that comes to mind. Ready?
Okay.
All right. Yeah. We got this. Your favorite spot in New Orleans?
Ooh. Let's see. So there is a hotel in the CBD district in New Orleans called the Ace Hotel, and they have this rooftop where you get like a 360 view of the city. And it is my favorite place to write. I wrote my very first feature there, so it holds a very special place in my heart. So yeah, I think the rooftop's called Alto, like a rooftop bar restaurant, and it's at the top of the Ace Hotel.
All right. I will put it at the top of my list because I love to get to New Orleans whenever I can. I'm jealous that you had the chance to grow up there. That must have been quite an experience. Next question, cake or ice cream?
Ice cream. Hands down.
Ditto. Favorite college hangout?
Ooh, like hangout spot?
Yeah. Like where you go chill with your friends or write or whatever.
Yeah. It's either, I'll give two. There's a coffee shop close to campus called Nature's Brew. They have great breakfast and great coffee. And then the third floor balcony at the USC Film School is unparalleled place to write.
I see you like these terrace-like spots.
I do like to be high up.
How would you describe your style as a storyteller in just a few words?
Dramatic comedy.
The role of a director is to they're huge questions. Take your time.
I know they're supposed to be top of my head. The role of a director is to be a voice for every creative involved.
The most important thing a film can do?
Say something.
Film school.
Is what you make out of it.
Couldn't agree more. And finally, the All-American High School Film Festival.
The starting point for every young aspiring filmmaker.
Oh, thank you. We try. All right. So now let's dive deep into all things Kelly Yu. It's wonderful to connect with you today, and I definitely want to get into some of your outstanding recent work, especially your latest project, Plumtown, that, of course, I can't watch yet because it's on the festival circuit, but I hope I'll be first in line when it's ready. But let's start by talking about your experiences doing commercial work as a freelancer. How did you get into it? What have you learned? And what advice do you have for our community who might be interested in making some cash while doing what they love?
Yeah. So I guess I got into it kind of also under different strange circumstances. I think coming from like a very Chinese family, I grew up kind of feeling like I had paths laid out already for me based on, you know, what everyone around me was doing. So it was like, you know, you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer or a scientist. My dad's a professor and my mom's an accountant. So STEM kind of felt like the most obvious thing that I was supposed to do. And very early on, I think after I failed my second grade fractions quiz, I knew I like did not have a single bone. I think I will never forget the memory of being in second grade math and my math teacher in front of the entire class being like, today I gave out my first F in all of my years of being a math teacher. And I went home and cried and was like, you know what? It's fine. I'm just not, you know, I don't have the math gene. I don't have the science gene. It took my parents very long time to come to terms with it. But in high school, especially when it was kind of like college admissions was nearing, I was like, what are you going to do? I clashed with my parents a lot over it. They couldn't really understand why I wasn't putting the time I was putting into film and photography into like ACT tutoring. And one day I remember like being very, I think like 14 or 15, my mom was like, you're never going to make any money if you don't pursue STEM. And I kind of had the attitude. I was like, bet, like, okay, it's on. Like, I will prove it to you. You say I won't ever make any money. I'm going to go prove to you that I can make money with a camera. And my parents are the type of people where like, if you have to prove them wrong for them to come around and like support you fully. So at the time I was at an arts high school and the concentration I was taking was media arts, which was kind of photography, video, graphic design. It was my kind of first foray into this. Previously I was doing orchestra, I was doing music. I had never really picked up a camera, but I had taken some photography classes, some videography classes, and I remember just taking portraits of my friend down the street from our school just for fun. I used to do that a lot. I would just like ask whoever to model and post them on Instagram. And we were taking photos outside this new gelato store. And it was the cutest gelato storefront I've ever seen. There were two gigantic teddy bears outside. It was very European. And I went in and I was just like, the owner was the only one in the store. I was like, hey, I take photos. If you ever need any photos done, you know, for your Instagram, I'd be happy to do so. And I got his business card. And the next day his wife called me and his wife kind of handles like the marketing side of the restaurant. She's like, hey, do you want to come in? You know, we are looking for Instagram photos. And I came in and they were the first, I guess, quote unquote, client I ever got. They're now like my godparents. I love them to death, but they were the first people to take a chance on, you know, a 15-year-old with like no previous work, like no professional experience. And they're like, yeah, you know, we'll hand you, it wasn't a lot of money, but it was money. And I remember going home to my mom and being like, hey, so remember what you said about that money thing? I just made like $20 and I, you know, took photos. And from there on, I think I just went door to door. Like I hit up local businesses. I hit up local brands on Instagram and was just like, hey, I'll shoot for free. And I did that for a little bit, built up a resume. And then I think the first serious gig I got was for, back then Google had this new venture called Zagat. I think it's not around anymore, but it was kind of a restaurant review site that they were linking to their search engine.
Yeah, I remember that.
And yeah. And the production company they outsourced to reached out to me. It was like, hey, we don't really know any New Orleans photographers. We found your Instagram. We're compiling. We have a list of the 15 most like top restaurants in New Orleans. We will pay you to go to all those restaurants, like order their entire menu, photograph it, and you can eat it. Like bring a friend, you know, wherever, and you can eat the food. And that was the first legit thing. And looking back now, like I was so young, I was pulling up with my friends, like those restaurants, like the manager would look at me and be like, are you sure? Like, yeah, you don't look like you're, you know, from Google.
And I'll take one of everything.
Yeah, I was like, you know, I sat there, I was like, I'm from Google. And if you want your restaurant to be reviewed nicely, then, you know, bring out your best. But that was as a 15-year-old, I think. And that is what bugged my parents too. They're like, oh, wait, like, she's actually, you know, making money and doing this. And yeah, then my parents just put all their support behind me. And they're like, you know, do this photography thing, do this film school thing. And yeah, they've been very supportive ever since.
Okay, that, first of all, that's an amazing trajectory and story. You clearly are a hustler who's willing to do whatever they can for the craft and their passion for art. And you're a survivor. I mean, how many people in your place would have taken the other path and ended up, you know, ultimately in a life of unhappiness and unfulfillment, and yet you refuse to be defeated? I am incredibly inspired by that. And obviously there's a little luck involved, but you had to be out there doing it for Google to even find you, right? And so it's like a testament to just keep pursuing the craft and the opportunities will come. I mean, it really resonates with me too, that you mentioned like orchestra and band, right? Because like that's like more accepted in the Asian culture, like maybe as an artistic mm-hmm. pursuit. And that's a big part of our mission. And that's why we want to exist for you, because I hope that, you know, your success with us also helped your parents see like, oh, this is legitimate. She's getting a lot of respect for her talent and for the effort she's putting into her work. I mean, that's amazing. And you're still doing this freelance work to this day.
Yeah, I mean, now I kind of do less of, I do photography, videography here and there, but right now I primarily freelance edit. So I work primarily for, I do some branded like ad agency things here and there, but primarily for like online YouTube content creators and influencers. And it's, you know, it's like just a side hustle, but it's also, it opened my eyes a lot to another world of like content creation. Like these are independent content creators who have built a career essentially like being a one-man band, you know. They film everything, they shoot everything, they upload it, and it's like a business. And then, you know, I just come on and support and help edit their videos. But yeah, that's been fun. I mean, I think if there's anything I learned from doing this, you know, at such a young age, it's that like hustle and that entrepreneurship, it applies to filmmaking as well. Like the commercial stuff and narrative stuff, it's not that different, because I entered film school and USC film school is so like Hollywood, so studio, like this is how it's traditionally done. A lot of the mindset that people had is like, oh, everyone here is talented and we are going to USC and that name is going to get us whatever job we want. But very quickly I realized it's the same thing. Like you have to put yourself out there. You have to cold call, you have to cold email, you have to, you know, network and, you know, actively be pursuing things. And yeah, I carry a lot of the like entrepreneurial skills I had to develop in high school to what I do now with like pitch decks and emails and, you know, social media outreach. It's kind of it's all the same thing. I mean, using literally the skills I used as a high schooler, you know, making YouTube videos and taking Instagram photos.
I mean, and all of that preparatory work, I'm sure put you in a position to have a lot more confidence than you probably had back then. I have to ask before we move on, did you gain a lot of weight during this Google experience?
You know what? I think I was so nervous about presenting myself as a legitimate photographer, because I knew. I was like, I know I look so young. I don't think I touched a single bit of food.
You just took pictures.
I always brought a friend. I only took pictures. I was just like, I have to, you know, and there's no getting around just like looking young. But I don't know, in my head, I was like, if I like don't really talk and I just like, you know, take photos, I'm gonna, you know, make up for the fact that I don't look that old. But yeah, I don't really think I ate anything.
Well, maybe that's what helped bring your parents around. You would just get all these to-go bags and bring them home all this amazing food. And they're like, all right, maybe this will work. I want to shift gears and like go all the way back and start talking about filmmaking specifically. When did you first start making movies and why?
Yeah, so I think the first film I ever made was a stop motion drama about eraser caps. And I was in the eighth grade. eraser caps, like wanting to be saved from, you know, students who are going to use them and erase themselves away. I did not come from a film background. My parents didn't really watch movies. I wasn't raised on like Star Wars or anything, but I was a huge fantasy nerd I loved reading fantasy, and I fell in love with Lord of the Rings, and I fell in love with the film trilogy, and I was so obsessed that after I finished the trilogy, I went and watched every hour of the behind the scenes making of documentary. And that was like my first look into the world of filmmaking. And I was just so intrigued by the idea that like all these different people come together with different skill sets and they work together and they make a film that everyone watches. And that was about the time, I think I was in eighth grade, where my middle and high school were in the same building. But high school is when you pick, like I previously said, like an arts concentration. And in eighth grade is when you do like the prep class. So if I wanted to do media arts, I would take, I think it was like intro to media arts. And, you know, was going back and forth between orchestra and media arts. I eventually realized like if I did media arts, music would always still be there. But if I continued to do music, I probably wouldn't have dipped my toes into film. So I was taking an intro class and the first assignment was like make a 2-minute short. And a lot of my classmates were, I think they had more experience than me. So they were shooting, you know, with actors and they were shooting, you know, real life, live action things. And I think I wasn't as confident in my abilities, you know, as an eighth grader. And so I was more familiar with photography. So that's why I was like, I'll do a stop action thing or stop motion thing. So I don't know why. I just like saw a bunch of eraser caps lying around and I like drew faces on them and kind of wrote this story about how like it's these eraser caps desperately wanting to stay alive in a classroom. Because, you know, when you like erase them, they eventually disappear. So that was a quick little thing, and my eighth grade prep teacher was so supportive. She tried to get that film submitted into the high school film festival. There's like a showcase every year, and they were like, no, like there's no way we're letting an eighth grader in it. But yeah, I think that was the first thing I ever did.
It's amazing to me that the theme was already sort of like your style of, as a storyteller was already present then, because it's like, it's kind of funny. I mean, I imagine I haven't seen it, but it sounds like kind of funny, but also very tragic at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wish I could, I have no idea where it is. It might be long lost. I wish I could dig it up. But yeah, I guess, you know, you're always drawn to the same thing, which is like how you kind of navigate multiple emotions. And obviously like at such a young age, like I wasn't conscious of it, but yeah, I think it comes from like different influences, like with family and background and upbringing. So yeah.
And why do you like to do this? Like why is it so important? I mean, you've continued on this, you've had a very interesting, you know, foundation. It certainly sounds like it. Why do you want to keep doing this? Why are you pursuing it in school? What drives you to keep telling visual stories?
It's freedom. It literally is the only freedom that I see. I felt so confined, like growing up, I felt like I didn't have any other out. I was like, oh shoot, I'm, you know, it's either business school or, you know, some sort of like STEM career and I'm not going to be happy. And I didn't really know what I could actively do to escape that. And filmmaking to me, like it's like actively taking control over your life. And I was always obsessed with forging my own path. And filmmaking to me is like, it's the ultimate escape. It's literally, you are forging your own path and you are creating, you know, the stories and the narrative that you want to tell. And I think as I also got older, I started to be more sensitive to stories around me. So I know we'll get to this. I don't want to jump the gun, but Plum Town, for example, is like based off of, you know, me going back to China for the first time and hearing my grandfather's story. And I never really felt connected to that side of my family because I grew up here. And yeah, so, you know, the idea that you can tell a personal story in the form of a film and also involve all the things that you love. Because I always had I'm an only child, so I attribute a lot of it from that.
Oh, even more pressure on you.
Well, I guess less pressure, but more of like, I was just bored. I didn't have anyone, you know, aside from friends, like I didn't have siblings to play with. Holidays always felt they didn't feel like holidays. What is Thanksgiving if it's just a regular dinner with your parents? You know, it's like all your relatives are in China. So I think growing up, I was always like, it was writing and reading and music and art. And then, you know, entrepreneurship as I got older. And I was so scared of having to choose one over the other. hence that like dilemma in high school. It's like, is it orchestra or is it film? And realizing that film is the amalgamation of everything I loved. Filmmaking is writing, right? It's writing, it's photography, it's music.
It's people, it's working with people and building a family. And I couldn't agree more. That's why I've dedicated my life to helping young people continue to pursue it, because I love it as a vehicle for immersive education and as a freedom, as an outlet for all of those different things that we all have going on inside of us. And you have to have it all to do it well. Clearly you do. And you didn't jump the gun by bringing up Plumtown, because you actually provided me a perfect transition. My next question is, which of your films are you most proud of and why? I didn't watch Plumtown, as I mentioned, but I did watch everything else that I could on your site. I mean, you make films about the last goldfish on the planet, and the cloud enthusiast, of all things, that is his caretaker. Which project are you most proud of?
I would say Plumtown, because Plumtown is, I would consider that my directorial debut, because it's the first short I, you know, raised a actual, you know, working budget, and I actually got to direct. It wasn't just, you know, me behind the camera and also working with like friends. I got the luxury of solely directing and working with professionals. And that is like an experience like I'll never forget. I think you never forget like your first actual project. But yeah, Plumtown, in a sense, like I'm proud of it because it's a very personal story and it's based off of a larger feature that I wrote about my grandfather. But you mentioned Endling, which I made for my third class. And that one there wasn't a really budget. It was made with, you know, four-person crew. But I'm actually very proud of the themes in Endling. It's, I think, encompasses more the direction I want to go into, which is kind of straddling that line between like absurdity and humanity. And everything I do now is kind of taken from real life. And not a lot of people know, but that goldfish story is based loosely on this Atlantic article about a man who lives in Hawaii, and he's dedicated his entire life to taking care of the last snail species. It's a snail species that like nobody has ever heard of. And he's just on this remote island taking care of them. And one day he never leaves the snail like encampment. And one day he just went to like go to the bathroom, and he came back and the snail had died. And the article kind of notes about how like there wasn't any fireworks or alarms or anything. It's just like quietly the snail died and nobody will ever know, but it was the last of its species. So I think, you know, the thematics of that is something I'm very proud of. It's kind of the direction I want to go into. But Plumtown, I think, will always, you know, I will hold a special place in my heart for it. It was a very, it was an endeavor that I learned a lot from. And it was challenging in like a lot of aspects. But yeah.
I have to ask, based on your description of Endling and the inspiration for it, which is awesome. That's how inspiration comes sometimes from the most unlikely places. But now, I, having seen the film, and I hope everyone listening will check it out if we include a link to it, it makes perfect sense. I have to ask, have you seen My Octopus Teacher?
I haven't, but people keep telling me to. It's on my list. It's definitely on my list.
It's right up your alley.
Yeah.
And real. And yeah, I have a feeling you'll find a lot of inspiration in it. So tell me a little bit more about Plumtown. Is that an actual place? Is the title a reference to a real place?
It is not. You know, not enough people actually ask about it. I'm just like, I have an answer to it. they just don't question it. But so it's the plum in Plumtown comes from the wild plum trees outside of my grandfather's village. And so a little bit of background about it. When I visited China, all I knew about my relatives is that they are farmers. My dad's the youngest of five, and he's, I think, was, you know, born in a time where he was the only one in his family to have been able to go to school, had this natural gift for science, didn't get passed on to me, and, you know, was the only one who ever, you know, got to leave China and, you know, immigrated to America, gave me this life that I have. But all I know is like, okay, they are farmers. And when visiting China, I think I was 12, that's kind of the only common thing I could, you know, talk about with them. I would ask them questions. Like, I would watch them get up at 5 a.m. every morning and go to the fields and work. And then, you know, 5 years passed. When I was 18, when I graduated high school, I went back. And this time, I think, also, the only common thing I had was be like, so how is farming going? And my uncle was just like, oh, we don't do that anymore. Like, a few years ago, we sold the land to a corporation, and now they built a factory here, and we work in the factory. He was like, everyone's doing this now. It's like this whole national, like, push to, you know, increase the poverty or the quality of living in the countryside. So everyone's like buying up land and building factories. And I saw this as like an interesting dilemma, because it's like, you know, it's an erasure of our family history, and it's, you know, rapid urbanization and gentrification. But at the same time, you know, my relatives are making more money, and my cousins got to go to school. Mm-hmm. And I remember, so the plum comes from my grandpa taking me to the plum trees outside of his village and saying, those are planted by my grandfather, and they've withstood the test of time. So as long as those plum trees are there, then our family history will never be erased. So that's where the plum comes from. And when I came back, I wrote the feature, and the character is kind of based on me, and I was a photographer at the time, and I kind of envisioned her going back to China with a camera and just taking still life portraits and not realizing what the story that she had until she went back to America and developed those photos. And one day I was at the Broad Museum in downtown LA, and there's a photo exhibit called Pie Town. And it's by this photographer, Russell Lee. Are you familiar?
No, but I just love the connection.
Oh, you just said it. Yeah. Yeah. So after the Great Depression, the government employed all these photographers and sent them to kind of like small rural communities around America to document how like small towns were coping after the effects of the Great Depression. So Russell Lee got sent to this town in New Mexico called Pie Town. And it's called that because the residents are the small farming community, but they're known for their pies. And in the museum, they were just the most mundane portraits of farmers like looking into the camera or, you know, like harvesting cabbages. But it was just such a story. Like it struck such a chord in me, because it's like this is a third person observatory perspective into this mundane life, but yet it was so profound.
And those Depression era photos are so incredibly powerful, mm-hmm. and they are so real and brutal. I can mm-hmm. see why you were moved by it.
Yeah, but there was such joy in those photos too, because like the people, like they were a community, and they only needed their community, you know, and it was them like dancing and making pies, and you know, I was just like, I love the idea of something so mundane, you know, but these people probably never knew that, you know, people were looking at photos of them in the Broad, you know, in downtown LA, but now, you know, I know about their story. And so I was like, oh, okay, like, you know, I'll call it Plum Town as like an homage to this photo series and how the character is also a photographer. So yeah.
I'm so glad I asked.
Oh, I've only told this story like once. And people just take, they're like, oh yeah, I like the title, Plum Town. But you know, I have had people bring up the idea like, you know, it's not a plum town. You know, I think someone was like, I guess it would be more of a cabbage town if you think about it. Cause in the feature, like the farmers are cabbage farmers. And like, and also, you know, it's like a rural village, right? It's not a town. Like there are no like towns, you know, in the setting that you want. I guess people don't.
Cabbage Village just doesn't have the same ring to it that Plum Town does. And the story is fantastic. I cannot help but think about the connection, and you're probably not even aware that you're making it, but that farmers are very much scientists, and that's a huge part of what they do, even if it's innate and not necessarily studied and learned in a traditional school setting. And mm-hmm. that your themes in the films that I've seen from you are actually really scientific. So do not dismiss the fact that you may have inherited some of that science gene, and you might want to talk to your dad about it and be like, you know what? I was talking to Tom and he actually figured out that I am a bit of a science person. So that's kind of fascinating, whether you're aware of it or not.
I'm going to send this podcast when it comes out to my parents, and if they could frame an audio recording, I think they would.
We'll
they
make an NFT. We will totally.
Yes.
Well, I'm happy to provide that. So I guess let's talk for a second about the practical aspects of making this film. And obviously you said you made a short and not the feature. And I guess that's, you know, certainly understandable. But for the sake of our listeners who are, you know, like you were when you were in high school, or teachers listening and trying to give the right advice to their students, how did you go about raising the budget for the film? And what was it like you know, directing a legitimate crew for the first time.
Mm-hmm, totally. So we did a Kickstarter. That seemed like the most straightforward route for someone who, like, you know, doesn't come from money, didn't have any connections. And a lot of film school students do Kickstarters, so we had great, you know, templates to reference from. And going in, I had so many friends, and I talked to so many people who had done successful Kickstarters, and they were like, it's a full-time job, it's going to take over your life. And I knew that, but I think to an extent I was like, yeah, it's, you know, like, we'll launch an Instagram and we'll promote it, I'm sure, you know, like, it's and you do get told, like, you really only get one chance to do a crowdfund, because, like, make sure it's your passion project, because you can really, the beautiful thing about crowdfunding is you see how supportive your community is. It's like a chance for everyone who has supported you in the past to actually tangibly support you. And people want to do that if it's your passion project. So I think I knew Plumtown was what I wanted to do a crowdfund for. And Kickstarter is all or nothing, meaning if you don't hit your goal, you don't get any percentage of that. There are other popular sites where you get to keep whatever you raise. But we weighed the pros and cons, and we're like, you know what? What it does is it gives people a sense of urgency, and there's a higher stake. So we set it at, I think, 18,000. Our goal was 20,000, but we set it at 18 because we were a little nervous, set it for 30 days and just launched it. And if I could summarize the crowdfunding experience, boil it down, it's the first few days, it's going to be a spike, because it's everyone in your immediate circle on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, who's going to donate. So it's going to be your close friends, your classmates, your family. And then that kind of dips off after a few days, because you kind of lose momentum. And then it's about increasing outreach to your, like, tertiary circle. It's a lot of Instagram. It's a lot of Facebook, going into, like, relevant Facebook groups, all of that. And so, like, a few weeks pass and, you know, you're still 10,000 away from your goal. That's when I had to get creative. This is like a little secret that I don't talk about a lot for crowdfunding, but I went on LinkedIn. I utilized LinkedIn very heavily. And I think to an extent, like, I thought of the crowdfunding thing kind of like the entrepreneurship business model, where you offer value in exchange for something, right? Like, why is someone going to donate to your short if they don't get anything in return? Because your friends and your family will, but if you're looking for outside investors, they won't. So I quickly realized that there is a community out there of a lot of, whether they're tech investors or entrepreneurs, people who have that disposable income, have been fascinated with the film industry, but have no way in. So what they do is they kind of purchase the credits. So what a lot of Kickstarter campaigns do is they offer, let's say if you donate at X amount, then you get an associate producer credit. And it's just an IMDb credit. It doesn't mean anything. They have no control or no stake or say in your film. And so what is beautiful about LinkedIn is you can filter your searches, you can for occupation. And so I realized just by typing in associate producer, it gave me access to all these people who have previously bought, no, I don't want to say bought, but have like pledged for film campaigns. And I reached out to them and they were just like, yeah, let's do it. Like, they liked it. They checked it out. All of them, like, you know, I hopped on the phone and like, yeah, we'll donate, you know, $1,000 for an associate producer credit. And in the beginning, it bummed me out a little bit because it felt like auctioning off like my baby to strangers. So I would definitely like be careful. Like, it's easy to see who's like, you know, actually legit and, you know, has done this a lot versus, you know, creepy people. But what I ended up really enjoying about it is you build a community of people who are supporting you. So all our associate producers, there was like 11 of them, they were cheering us on through production, through post. When we went into production, they were like posting on Instagram, like, today, you know, Plumtown goes into production. And it was like, you feel like you have like a support team, like all over the world. And I met a few of them. They like came to our festival premiere and yeah, I met one of them. He was just like wearing the Plumtown merch shirt and just like showed up to a thing. So definitely, like, yeah, be careful about it, but there are like safe ways to do it. So yeah, that's kind of what we did. We crowdfunded and then pulled in some like outside investments on top of that and came out with a decent enough budget for us to be able to hire a professional. We hired professional department heads. And then it was a mix of like my classmates, and then my DP was a professional, has been working for a while. And then like recent alumni from like the grad program. So it was a very good mix of like professionals and students, which I loved about it. I remember looking around, you know, our crew and being like, I feel like it's kind of sad. Like the more successful you are and like the higher budget or like bigger projects you're working on, it's rare to look around and like see your friends, you know, and feel so safe and comfortable, which is what I miss so much about like student films. You know, you just, you're making things with your friends. And yeah, so you also asked the experience of directing for the first time. I was so scared. I felt so underprepared because I realized in the past, you can call yourself a director, right? But what you're really doing is you're kind of just shooting everything. And you're so like occupied about that. Cause usually in high school, like you shoot everything, you write, you do all the jobs. So you're not really ever just pure directing.
Like it's your lens when you're younger. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, in supplementary, the lead Rohan, I worked with him all throughout high school. And I think for a second, I was like, am I actually a good director? Or have I just been working with like talented actors my entire life? And, you know, they've made me look good. So there's a lot of like questioning that, but, yeah, I just tried to prepare as much as I could. I watched a bunch of masterclasses, read a bunch of books, talked to a bunch of previous directors. And there's only so much advice you can, like tangible advice you can give, like, right? Like don't give line readings and, you know, you talk to your actors this way. But I think there's only so much you can prepare. And once you step on set, it either kicks in or it doesn't, like those instincts. So I guess what my biggest takeaways were, I didn't have to know everything. It is okay to rely on your department heads and on other people that are more experienced.
Yeah, that's why they're there, right? I mean, I know that's hard, but yeah.
I learned so much just from working with my DP. You know, we would meet up for hours and just shot list and talk about the film. And what I loved about working with him is it wasn't just about the technical. We would just riff for hours about like random things that had to do with the film, but wasn't just like shot list, camera lenses, you know? And I think once you realize there's no shame in asking questions, I think a mistake a lot of young directors make is they walk on set and they feel like they have to put up a front. They have to pretend like they know everything. Even if they have a question, they're like, oh, I can't ask it because it'll make me look like I don't know what I'm doing. I have always believed in like, surround yourself with people that are better and more experienced than you. And yeah, I think I realized like also once you said in like I had a binder of like all my notes and all my preparation, I didn't reference it a single time on set because you don't have time to. You know, it's really just like you let your instincts kick in. And I think also like if I knew the story like the back of my hand. So it was just a matter of like, you know, if there were characters that needed adjustment, it was less of like how do I give them the specific technical notes to say what I want them to say and more of like, where are they coming from? So it was our main characters in Plum Town was a father and a son. And something I did beforehand was I went to the actor playing the father and I told him a secret about the son and told him not to say anything. And then I went to the son character and I told him a secret about the father. And that it all came from like personal experience. And because it was about disconnect. The scene was about disconnect and then eventual connection. So that helped a lot, you know, not feeling like everything had to be so technical and textbook and just, you know, drawing from personal experience and relaying that.
You made it about humanity.
Hopefully, yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. I can't help but think about a parallel to sort of when I was a teacher, how I would approach my presence in the classroom and how I communicated with my students. And a lot of teachers, for very good reason, go in and they're super strict, right? And that's their defense mechanism, you know, so that if you show a sign of weakness, then the class is going to pounce on you and take advantage and then you're going to lose control. And that was just never my personal style. I totally respect it and I understand why people do it. But I always approached my classroom in a very honest way, in a very human way. And I really wanted to show the students that I was vulnerable. But I was really passionate and that I appreciated them as human beings before I appreciated them as, you know, learners or something like that. And it definitely has its moments where people like to push because you're giving a lot more freedom. But in the end, if you do it right, it creates a real sense of community. And I don't think I could have lived in the classroom without that, by just being sort of a figure and not a human. And it sounds like your approach as a director is very similar. And I imagine everyone really liked working with you because of that. And just to go back on a few things that you said, first of all, providing that information about LinkedIn, and that's a big secret. Like, I'd never heard that before. And the fact that you're kind enough to share it, I think says a lot about you. And I think it's not a scary thing to share, because at the end of the day, you still have to sell what you're selling. You know, you still have to convince people that you are really passionate about this idea and that you're willing to do, you know, to fulfill their financial obligation, you know, to make it happen. It's a genius little idea. But I think it's really sweet of you to share it. I just wanted to ask too, just one more little practical thing. I'm just curious, were the donations that came in on the crowdfunding campaign, were they mostly small, or was it like an even split between larger donations and smaller donations? Just so that, like, if someone's doing a campaign, they don't get immediately discouraged or something.
Yeah. The average amount is like $25, you know, and every donation comes with like a reward.
Right.
So the $25 is like you get a copy of the PDF and a screener, you know, while it's on the festival circuit. But they range, you know, it's like 25, 10, 25, 50, 100. I think the average is 25. So for the associate producer level, we were offering it at 1,000, and we got 11 of those.
Wow.
So that was 11,000, you know, which is half of our budget basically. Don't underestimate the small portions. Mm-hmm. Like, they really add up. They really do.
Yeah,
I think we ended up with like 300 pledges. And, you know, if half of those are at 25, like, that's a very significant amount.
Yeah, I'm glad I asked. I think it's, you know, just really interesting perspective for people. So let's talk about your experience at USC. I know you said when we were talking before we started recording that you have one more semester. So congratulations. And shocker, everyone, Kelly's graduating early. I don't think that's any surprise based on what she shared with us so far and her work ethic. What has your college experience been like?
So I want to be super honest, and I will, because I think there's a lot of, like, you know, high school students entering film school that are going to be listening. My first year was amazing. I think coming from a place like New Orleans, where there's a very small filmmaking community, I always made everything on my own. I felt like I was at Disneyland. I was like, oh, I'm in a cohort of 50 kids and everyone is doing this. And I'm going to work with everyone on everything. And there's screenwriters and there are designers and animators. And it was great. First semester, we didn't really do any production classes. But second semester, our first intro class was you just make 8 like 2-minute films. And there's a different prompt every week. And to be honest, I don't think I've ever been as creative. I have not been that creative since that class. I think my full creative endeavors at school ended after that first semester. That first class, I poured everything into it. And they were like one man productions too. Like, you just take your camera, you can shoot whatever. The prompts were like one location challenge, or like, I think one of them, they were like, Snapchat is the future, so make a vertical film. And we would just run around, and sometimes they would do like rapid challenges. Like, you have 30 minutes, go. And, you know, 10 of my classmates and I would, like, you know, tag team and go to one location and help each other shoot. And that was just like, it felt like Disneyland. And I formed great friendships. But what happened, and I think a lot of it is also COVID, because COVID happened, we all got sent home my second semester freshman year around March. We all got sent home and everything was on Zoom. And I think naturally people split off, you know, these like friendships, kind of like cliques that you make freshman year because you're all put in one room and told to be friends. I think they naturally kind of like people go in different directions. So through COVID, I moved back to LA with 2 of my film school classmates and then 2 of my friends who are in different majors. And that was also a great experience because it was the 3 of us confined to an apartment and we were still having film assignments. We didn't get any set experience, but, you know, it was interesting to make that work. We only had, 900 square feet. And then every week it was like, how do you make a different film out of the location? So I look back on that experience fondly too. And so my sophomore year, we were still doing online classes. That's when I started to do Plum Town, to put Plum Town together, and got amazing support from my classmates. And then May is when we shot. And that was, Plum Town, I think, was the first production where USC students kind of got back on set. Like the classmates that I had on set, they were like, we actually, our AD like had a little crisis because he's like, our first day was so tight. Like every shot was planned for minute by minute. He's like, I know people are going to arrive on set and socialize. I do not blame them. They have not seen their friends in 2 years. But also our first day happened to be like the hardest day. So it was really fun, like being on set for the first time, and being with my classmates. But so I'm graduating a semester early because one, I realized I can. Our coursework is set out where everyone can actually graduate a semester early. Your last semester, you just take electives. And so I personally was like, okay, I'll save that money and just actually, instead of taking a class on how to make a music video, I could just make a music video. So everyone actually fulfills all their credits early. The reason I'm also doing it is after Plum Town, and I think you can call it quote unquote success. I define success in like many different reasons. I guess people say like success with Plum Town because I think I successfully raised a budget and made something independent out of school. I think just weren't the same after I got back to class. We went back to in-person classes for my junior year and everything was different. It was a mix of classmates who were hurt that they weren't hired or invited to be a part of Plum Town. And I could make all the excuses in the world. I could say it was a closed set because of COVID, I brought on my friends and the rest, I hired professional crew or, people who were, I wanted to work with a professional DP. And I think that rubbed people the wrong way because the mentality at USC is like, you're at the best film school in the world. So why do you feel the need to hire a professional DP? I had friends and classmates who wanted to be DPs who were hurt that I didn't hire them.
Sure. Yeah.
It's film school, everyone here is still kids. Like there's ego and there's, people get butt hurt. I don't blame it. But I think there's a culture at USC where the mentality is like, you should be lucky that you're here. And Plum Town opened my eyes to a world outside of school, where I got to meet a lot of people who are outside of the film school bubble. And I quickly realized like the path I want to take is to make independent projects outside of school. I didn't want to wait around to be handed anything. I didn't want to fight for like the one, the senior thesis slot, and there were only four of them. And I was also finding some success, with my writing and with Plum Town. And I think naturally people get a little insecure. They get, and a lot of people who I used to call my friends stopped talking to me. And one day I was just, I heard from a friend that people had just decided that I had changed. Mm. I think the common consensus was like, yeah, so she thinks she's better than us. She thinks she's better than USC. So I was called names. I was labeled a certain way. And what was interesting is these people saying these things about me, I hadn't talked to since freshman year.
Right.
I think one day I was just like, okay, you guys think I'm all these things, but none of you guys are talking to me. Like I stopped being invited to things. I stopped being, and naturally I think I lost an interest in like going to frat parties and going, it didn't interest me anymore. But that was seen as like, if I didn't appear at a party, people were like, she's better than us.
Right,
she's
right.
Snobby. She's gotten a taste for whatever. And, she thinks she's better than us now. And in reality, it was like, guys, I just don't like, I don't like frat parties anymore.
And look, it hurts, right? I mean, it's hurtful. And the fact is you did change, but not necessarily in the ways that others were perceiving it. And
yeah,
you can only control yourself. You can't control them. That sounds like a tough run.
Yeah. And I say this because I don't think it gets talked about enough, especially in the regards of like young filmmakers navigating this. Because
the politics of it. In a sense.
Right. I've done a lot of podcasts. I've done a lot of talks where it's like, okay, so like, how is it making a successful short while being in film school? But, you know, the ramifications of it. And it was, I luckily had a great support group, but it was tough. Like, I wanted to drop out of school for a second, you know, because I thought I was strong. But hearing all these things about you, being dropped by people you thought were your closest friends, you know, that was tough. And only recently where I've talked to people who, you know, recent graduates at USC, like, yeah, you know, I did the independent thing and I, that ruffled a lot of people's feathers too. But, you know, I'm the only one in my class to be actually actively directing now, you know? So it's like, you weigh what you want. And there, I do have like, I have an amazing support system and like friends who, you know, genuinely, you know, can see through that. But yeah, I think it's, yeah, just the mentality, like there is also a world outside of film school. And yeah, I know it's such a tough thing to juggle. Yeah. Like juggling, like you're remembering that you're still a 19, 20 year old, you know?
Yeah.
And in college versus, you know, trying to be this filmmaker, trying to make it in the outside world.
Well, I really appreciate you being so candid about it. And frankly, we don't talk about this kind of stuff enough on the show because there is so much to discuss on the film side. And obviously, you know, that's wisdom we want to impart. But, you know, the emotional side of it is also really important, probably more important. And it certainly sounds like you got everything you needed to out of USC and that you made the right decisions toward the path that you ultimately want to take. So I'm happy for you in that regard.
Thank you.
I can't wait to see what's next for sure. I want to just briefly talk about your experience with All American. You know, you mentioned that the recognition was a stepping stone, and I certainly appreciate that. That's what we want to be. What advice would you have for our community of young filmmakers? You know, things, and maybe you just gave it, and that's fine. But maybe, you know, things that you know now that if you were talking to your younger high school self, that you would want to share.
Yeah, I mean, in direct relation to All American, I think just put yourself out there, like submit to as many festivals. And I remember that email I sent you. I was like, there's no way I could have, like, you know, something, because I didn't even apply. So I didn't even submit to the festival. And that was because I think one, there wasn't really a culture of that in my high school, especially in New Orleans. Like there's no really like pipeline to Hollywood, LA, New York. Like, yeah, my media arts high school teacher was like, yeah, I have never heard of, you know, these high school film festivals. There wasn't, versus my friends who I met at USC were like, oh yeah, we've been applying to All American like our entire high school career. I think a part of it too is like I was just so intimidated and so scared. Also using a lot of copyrighted music. but I, you know, if you don't put yourself out there, even if there's the chance of rejection, you never know.
I could not agree more. Yep. And I think that is amazing advice because I think a lot of filmmakers submit to us, and if they don't make the cut, then like they think that they're not any good or that we didn't see what their work was about. It's really competitive. I mean, we've received thousands of submissions every year. We can't let everything in, but I think that rejection or learning from that is actually the best lesson of all. Like, okay, they're telling me where the bar is set. I need to work harder, or maybe they just didn't get my vision. I need to keep doing what I'm doing. I think that's really important.
Yeah. I think there's no shame in rejection. I think a lot of, I think a lot of institutions and schools, like they dance around, they want everyone, you know, everyone is great. You know, like I have seen many bad films, bad student films. And in the notes process, you know, especially at film school, like everyone has to give notes. Everyone is so scared of being, and I think there's a way to do it, right? There's a way to not hurt people's feelings and still encourage them. But I don't see anything bad in being honest. Like, the bar is here, right? Like you said, and it should be actually encouraging to know that the bar is here and you can take active steps to get there. It's just, I would actually be more discouraged if like you hit the bar already. It's like, then it's like, where do you go?
Yes.
You
know? Yep. I talk about that all the time. And I worry about it a lot because I know I'm working with young artists and I know how vulnerable that can be. I worry, and I do. I mean, I do want to like embrace everyone and say, here, I see, you know, but with thousands, you can't actively communicate with everyone on that level. But I want to say, like, I see your strengths. Keep building on these, you know? Yeah, I beat myself up about that a lot. And I just hope that, you know, people can see the bigger picture. But then I think about someone like you, whose parents are sort of actively saying, like, you know, this, we'd rather you didn't go down this path. It's going to be really hard. And you know, how easy it is to give up or give in to pressure. But you got to keep fighting. If this is what you want to do, I mean, whether or not you become successful as a great director is really not even really the conversation, right? The conversation is, how can you be a part of this industry to work your way to the point where you want to be, you know, because there's so many opportunities now. One more question I want to ask, because we didn't talk about your gifts as a photographer at all. And if you're listening and you get a chance to click on the links in the description, definitely check out Kelly's photographs. What are the differences between photography and film? And then what are the similarities? Are you doing like both equally, or are you pretty like much more focused on film now?
Yeah, I'm much more focused.
Okay, on film. I just asked like seven questions.
Very rarely. No, they're great questions. Oh my gosh. Well, I would not be where I am without photography. I think photography in this sense is different because there aren't that many moving pieces, right? You don't have to worry about sound and editing and writing. Photography, you set up the shot, you know, you arrange the model, and then you press the shutter and you manipulate it, you know, after. But the similarities is that direction, I think. Because you're still working with like a living human, breathing human being. And a lot of like the directing I do now, I'm like, okay, this isn't so different from like directing, you know, a model, right? Because it's about getting someone comfortable behind the camera, getting someone to do what you want them to do. I think most importantly, it's that like visual eye. Like it really trained me for visuals because you only, with photography, you get one shot to convey what you want to convey. Yeah, so I mean, I think the visual and the directing part more so with like portraits, with like stage portraits, which I did a lot of. But I also did a lot of like event photography. And I don't mean like corporate events. Like I shot a lot of like weddings and parties. And one of the most shoots I remember very fondly of is my friend who's Armenian. She invited me to shoot their like Armenian wedding. And it was such this multicultural event where there was a lot of dancing involved, like a lot of colors and dancing. And I like those photos because it captured all of that spirit. You know, you get one shot to capture it, capture everyone dancing, the bride and groom dancing. Like they, and it's like a very specific kind of dance they do where everyone forms a circle and they go around. And it almost like film feels like a luxury because it's like with photography, if you only get one shot to capture it, oh, now you get 24 shots a second, you know, to capture it. I think it all goes hand in hand. With film, you just get to tell a bigger story.
I really like that. That's a great way to describe it. It's, yeah, a lot of pressure on photographers, especially at live events like that. I always feel for the ones documenting our festival. What's next? Projects in the works? Is the feature going to get made? What's next for Kelly Yu?
Yeah, so people ask about Plum Town the feature a lot. Right now, it's kind of, I talk a lot about like, just because it's a passion project doesn't mean it has to be the current project. Plum Town is like my dream. Like it is the most personal story to date I've ever written, but I don't think now is the time to tell it. Also on like a more development technical note, like it's set in China, it's set in rural China. The politics of shooting in China right now are insane. So that's also a very like practical reason. It's hard to get anything made. You know, Asian American films now, like there's such a, you know, support for that, which is what we've been fighting for so long. But even then, like, it's hard to get Asian American films made. And then Plum Town is more like Chinese. So it's, you know, it's, yeah, we'll see where, you know, the political climate goes. But right now I'm in prep for a project I'm super excited about. It is a short proof of like an actual proof of concept for a feature I've been writing called Family Land. And it's about the Asian family rental company. So in Japan, it started in Japan, but there's these very widespread companies where you can rent a family member. They employ a network of like freelance actors. And if you need like a dad for a day, or if you need you know, a girlfriend for a day. You can go to this company and rent them. And it's so innocent. It's like, there's a lot of rules in place. Asia is the kind of country where, like, it's such a big population, but people are very lonely and mental health support is kind of stigmatized, right? Like there's, in here we pay a therapist like $200 an hour to listen to our problems. They don't have that in Asia. So their equivalent, I guess, is paying a fake dad, you know, $200 an hour to, you know, take them out to dinner and listen to their problems. But I was doing research into the businesses and I learned about how there are people who've been renting like dads for their daughter for their entire life. So there's a girl out there who's like my age who thinks her dad is her dad, but her in reality, you know, her mom's been renting the dad for her entire life. And that's because like children of single parents are like very heavily bullied. Like, you know, like there's a lot of reasons for it. And a lot of what I want to focus on now is destigmatizing like the East, kind of like the East meets West lens. Cause I think the West, like Western audiences are very fascinated with like cultural absurdities in like Asia, but trying to bridge that and being like, you know, we're not that different, you know, it's all kind of the same. So that's what the feature is about. It's about a girl who realizes her dad, her entire life, you know, her dad's been an actor and kind of goes on this journey to figure that out. It's kind of like a little bit like Parasite meets the Japanese film, The Shoplifters. Mm-hmm. So right now I'm working on the short, which is kind of a hybrid of many genres because with Plum Town, I'm very proud of like the direction, but it was very kind of like safe filmmaking. It was very straightforward, like just conversation between two characters. And now that I was like, okay, I think I can, you know, direct that interpersonal relationship between characters. Now I kind of want to play with different genres and get kind of crazy with it. So it starts out as this traditional narrative drama of a girl and her father. And when she realizes her father is a paid actor when she stumbles across a commercial. And we're going to shoot the commercial for this company. So what does that look like? It's this absurd hyperpop Japanese inspired game show commercial. And we're shooting it with virtual production. So we're building all the sets in Unreal Engine, which is this game software. And we're going to be using that LED screen, the Unity screens that a lot of shows like The Mandalorian are shooting on. So we're working with a lot of cool like tech companies and trying to just bridge. I think we're at a unique intersection right now where like narrative traditional filmmaking is meeting like new technology. So it's exciting to like be part of that. So just, yeah, being able to work with a lot of different people in different fields. Yeah, just like it's a kind of like an experimental. If it totally fails, I'm here for it, you know, because I would rather invest another year and a half of my life into something challenging than kind of do the same thing again, which is like another drama. So
yeah, great perspective. Yeah. I am beyond excited about this concept coming to life. I absolutely love that inspiration. I did not know about this practice, and I feel like I'm like fairly in tune with Asian culture and some of these phenomenons, mm-hmm. which you are trying to sort of deconstruct for the West. I also really appreciate that notion, but I was unaware of this, and now I am incredibly intrigued, and I see the huge potential of sharing this story in the right way, and I have no doubt that with your talents and vision, you're going to figure it out. So I want to leave our listeners, this is sort of tradition on the show, with some recommendations of the films on your playlist or radar right now. It doesn't even have to be a film. It can be anything. It can be music, an art exhibit. But certainly if there's a show that you've been watching or something you saw recently that you're excited about that folks might want to check out and get a little more insight into what you enjoy.
Yeah. Well, I'll give a few. I think first,
full disclosure, I like secretly do this for myself so I can just get like a really good playlist. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, totally. Just, you know, asking for a friend. Yeah. I've been listening to this podcast called Script Notes for forever. It's a screenwriting podcast hosted by Craig Mazin, who wrote Chernobyl, and John August, who's written so many feature films. And they're, I think, the best resource for aspiring screenwriters. I think it's even better than anything you can learn at film school. every episode is about a different thing. They have showrunners and screenwriters on as guests, and they do this interesting thing called the 3-page challenge. And I bring this up because I was just listening to this, where people submit 3 pages of their screenplay and they literally dissect everything, and you learn so much from it. So Script Notes, great podcast. What I've been watching, I watched, well, this is a rewatch, but there is a feature film by a Japanese writer-director called We Are Little Zombies. And I rave about this all the time because it is, I think, a true, based on a, so the short proof of concept premiered at Sundance in 2018, I think, and it's the first foreign language film to win best short at Sundance. And that, if you watch the short, it's on YouTube. It's called And So We Put Goldfish in the Pool. It is the craziest 30-minute short you will ever watch. It mixes, it's like live action meets experimental, stop motion. It's insane. And it's a lot of sensory overload. But what I love about it is at its core, it has a very simple message. And it's about a group of teenage girls who feel stuck in their lives because they're from this small town in Japan, and it's about them wanting to get out. And so that's also a great, I think, thing to watch for people who are, I hear proof of concept thrown around a lot these days. Everyone is like, my short's a proof of concept for, and I said the same thing about Hometown until I realized it really wasn't a proof of concept. Proof of concept, I think, is more applicable to if your short has like very similar, unique tone or style that you are trying to showcase and your feature's going to be like this. I think Plumton like had the same thematics, but it is very different from the tone of the feature. So it's not really a proof of concept. But this short, if you watch it and then you watch the feature, you can see it is literally a proof of concept. Like someone watched the short, was like, okay, I understand the director's vision. Here's money to make your feature. And the feature is, it's, I would classify it as like dark, absurd comedy. It's about 5 orphans that meet at a crematorium because all their parents have died, and they decide to form a rock band. And it's kind of like Scott Pilgrim because they use like the video game format, but they go like crazy with it. So I think it's like a very unique gem that like not many people have seen. So I really recommend that.
I love it. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. And then I guess next movie, I think everyone's talking about this, but Everything Everywhere All at Once is incredible. It's also like doing a lot of things, but it has a very simple message at its core, and it's about family. So if you haven't seen that, I recommend seeing that too.
And I have not, and I refuse to see. I heard that you can watch it now streaming, but I need to see it in the theater. I don't get to the theater enough.
You do.
Yeah. And so it's like, Of course, I need to go see Top Gun 2. And believe it or not, everyone's like, it's really good. And so I'm excited. But
oh, I thoroughly enjoyed Top Gun.
That's all I hear.
I went in, I wasn't familiar with the first one. I went in thinking this is just going to be some like box office grab action film. Like it's going to be entertaining, but it's going to be bad. I think I might go see it again.
Wow, that's high praise. Yeah. And that's the way the movie should be. And that used to happen all the time when I was young. You'd go see something and then you'd go see it like 2 or 3 more times. Well, that was the only option. But like if something moves you in that way, and especially if it's like a visceral experience, then you should go see it again. But yes, I need to get to these films soon before that they're not in the theaters. Well, listen, I want to thank you, Kelly, for an insightful glimpse into your experiences and motivations as a storyteller. I encourage all of you to check out Kelly's work. There will be links in the description. And of course, thanks to all of you for tuning in and joining us. I remind you that this is just one of many in-depth conversations with the future of film. You can go to hsfilmfest.com for more information on the All-American High School Film Festival. And please subscribe and share across all platforms to support our important community of artists. Just like Kelly. Thank you so much, Kelly.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
It was an absolute pleasure. We'll see you next time.